just, we're not necessarily, this is by C.S. Lewis. C.S. Lewis has so many quotable things. He says, we're not necessarily doubting that God will do the best for us. Does anybody here doubt that God will do the best for us? If you do, raise your hand and we'll have a talk. No, no, we don't. But then he goes on to say, we are wondering, so let me, I'll just repeat that. We are not necessarily doubting that God will do the best for us. We are wondering how painful the best will turn out to be. Is that interesting? Sometimes God's best is painful, and that was, we sang that this morning, talk about trial. You know, God is still there. God can still give us peace in our trial. Well, Larry has a picture, I shouldn't say, Larry has it. Larry's, you just work here. Got a picture here for us to see. Anybody know what that is? Remember that event? Can anybody say what that event is besides Larry? Yeah, it's an earthquake. Where? Yep, we're part of California. Yep, Oakland, yes, that's 880. One thing I saw, I call it the Nimitz Freeway, the Cypress, I guess at this point it's the Cypress Freeway. It's an earthquake. So, earthquake is something to fear, isn't it? What perhaps is your greatest fear? Anybody experience maybe an earthquake or a time in their life that they would just briefly like to tell us about? Only joy. Well, I've experienced three earthquakes, but they've all been in Illinois. Have I told you this before, this story? I was in the nursery one time, and I was in a rocking chair, and the rocking chair started going like this. I'm like, you know, I'm in the nursery, right? I'm thinking, is some kid behind me, you know, putting his foot? No, and then I found out later it was an earthquake up in it's felt in Palatine. And then in Naperville, there we experienced two of them, bad English. We had a light. We don't have these lamps anymore, but it was loose. And I woke up in the middle of the night, the lamp's going ding, 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 ding. I'm like, oh, that's weird. And then again, you know, then I found it was an earthquake that happened. And then again, so, but it wasn't fearful. I wouldn't fear. But we fear a lot of things. There's this, that we live in a fearful, broken world, don't we? We have earthquakes and floods. We have animals. We have bugs, right? Somebody, you see a bug, you know, we'd scream and bloody murder, mice, tornadoes, hurricanes, fear of man, fear for your children, fear for your spouse, fear of finances. We already talked about pain. Sometimes we fear ourselves, don't we? We know ourselves. Fear of relationships, fear of government, fear of another race. Our media seem to be fear mongers, aren't they? We fear climate change, as if our climate has never changed throughout the history of mankind, right? We are broken people living in a broken world filled with fear. Well, I invite you to turn in your Bibles to Psalm 46. And if you're using the Bible in the pew, it's on page 557. Page 557. Psalm 46. As you're turning there, our passage today talks about fear. It's interesting that the solution is very specific. The solution is obvious. But even though the solution is obvious, we still have problems with fear. Sounds strange, doesn't it? Now, certainly some people don't think that the solution is obvious. But for those of us who do, we still have problems with fear. Our constant battle with fear is a reason why we need to regularly read the Psalms, read the Bible, and pray. Fear, why? It's because fear robs us of life. We can't live life as God intended it if we are in a constant state of fear. The overall theme of this psalm can be found in the first stanza. First stanza is verses 1 to 3, so let me read those. God is our refuge and strength, a very present help in trouble. Therefore, we will not fear though the earth gives way, though the mountains be moved into the heart of the sea, though its waters roar and foam, though the mountains tremble at its swelling. Selah. So the overall theme of this passage is this: God is our fortress against fear. So that's the answer for the first blank, if you have a blank sermon note sheet. God is our fortress against fear. Now, I'm using the word fortress for two reasons. First, fortress is the word that's used in repetition at the end of the next two stanzas that we're going to look at. And second, the first phrase of verse 1 could be translated, God is our strong refuge. We're going to learn a new vocabulary word today. I don't think I've said this before. One of the challenges in translation is when to know when two words are talking about one thing instead of two separate things. The technical term is hendiadys. Hendiadys. It comes from the Greek. We won't get into that. But a hendiadys is the use of two words to express one concept. And what is another way of saying strong refuge? Well, fortress, as the psalmist repeats twice, that we'll look at in a bit. Is a fortress of any value if it is far away? No. You need to get there. You need to get there quickly. You want a fortress that is nearby. You want a fortress that is a very present help in trouble. This is another way of describing another vocabulary word that we've looked at, imminence, describing God's imminence. I'm going to read a portion from a resource that I really like. It's called the Baker Compact Dictionary of Theological Terms. So I refer to this a lot as I'm reading commentaries and things. Here's what it says about God's imminence. It's God's personal relatedness to and involvement in creation. He is not removed from the world, but actively engaged in everything that comes to pass. The rhythms of nature, the comings and goings of people, and the movements of history are all acts of God who is present in them. Indeed, he dwells with them who is of a contrite and lowly spirit. From Isaiah 57. To be avoided is an excessive notion of imminence by which God is equated with creation. So if you equate creation with God and they're the same, well, that's called pantheism, and that's obviously wrong. Or if God is contained in it, God is just a part of it, that's called panentheism. Those are all wrong. With the right balance, divine transcendence, which is God being far different from us, he is far, in a sense, he's far away, but he's also imminent. He's near. God's exaltedness, his transcendence, and involvement are affirmed. And I think the last time I preached on a psalm, I talked about, you know, the God of Islam, Allah. He is a transcendent God, but he is not imminent. He's not near. So that's one of the great things that we worship: a God who is near. We worship a God who is involved. He is interested in it. And this is what we should expect from our God. Why? Because he is our maker. Verse 2 introduces the reason we need a fortress: fear. Therefore, we will not fear. Since God is our strong refuge, our fortress, we will not fear. Now, that's easy to say, isn't it? Yeah, oh yeah, I'm not going to fear. Yeah, well yeah, then something comes along and what happens? We jump to fear. The psalmist gives us four phrases that begin with though. That is why I've entitled this sermon, Those. You know, it's almost like you read those and you're like, oh man. These four those describe in hyperbolic language what could be described as the worst thing that could happen on this earth. Something that causes us, one of the things that cause us fear. Hyperbolic language, this exalted language that poets use and the psalmists use to arouse emotion, to get us to feel things, to connect with the emotions that we have. Therefore, we will not fear. One, though the earth gives way, though the mountains be moved into the heart of the sea, though its waters roar and foam, though the mountains tremble at its swelling. Have you ever experienced anything close to those frightening things? If you have, I'm guessing you weren't sitting there sipping a latte or a cup of tea, just having a good, oh, Oh, look at these waters roaring and foaming around me. I'm just having such a good time. No, it's scary. I've come close, but nothing to describe this, the fearfulness of what is going on here. In the heading of Psalm 46, it's attributed to the sons of Korah. And that's why our scripture reading this morning was from Numbers, reading about the sons of Korah. The sons of Korah witnessed what? They witnessed the earth giving away and the earth swallowing up their father in rebellion, their rebellious father. But the sons of Korah did not die because they refused to be a part of their father's rebellion. Now the sons of Korah, generations later, have penned this psalm. And it's probably during the time of the kings. We don't exactly know. Some think it was around the time of Hezekiah, probably during the time of the kings. And talk about what would be an earth-shattering moment. How would you like to see the earth split open and to see people, your relatives, fall into the earth, be swallowed up? Think about the shame associated with that event. Your family, your father. Remember, this was a patriarchal society. Fathers were a big deal. Imagine for a moment that Hitler had sons and you were one of them. You and your brothers knew that your father was an evil man, and rather than support your father, you fled from Germany and you came to America. You escaped to America in order not to participate in his evil actions. Would you like to be forever known as a son of Hitler? Think about that. That's almost how bad this was. Korah rebelled against God and was swallowed up by the earth. Well, you may or may not want to be forever known as a son of Hitler. I certainly wouldn't want to be. But at least the sons of Korah are spoken positively about in the Bible, right? They were positive. There would be some comfort in that. In one sense, you would be viewed as someone who didn't reject God, but rejected their father, their own evil father. But the shame of that would linger with you to some degree. And the sons of Korah had a choice, didn't they? They had a choice to fear God. They made God their fortress and not their father. As a result, they were spared. I think one thing that this teaches us is that family is a revealer of fear, isn't it? Think about that. Parents and children do fearful things. If you're a parent, you can see your parents do fearful things. And if you're a parent, we certainly have seen our children do fearful things, right? Parents fear for their children. This is the other side of the coin compared to the Korah incident. And Korah, you know, the children are looking at their father, but parents are fearful for their children. And I think perhaps we use the word fear a little bit too loosely sometimes. It would be more biblically accurate to say that we are concerned for our children. But when we fear for our children, we have crossed a line. When does concern end and fear begin? Well, I think a biblical line can be drawn when we compromise our fear of the Lord. If our concern for our children or concern for any other family relationship turns into fear, then what's happening? God isn't our refuge anymore. And what can this fear do to us? It can be debilitating. Fear can debilitate us. It can show up in devastating grief, debilitating worry. Perhaps you've been that parent. You've been that spouse. The psalm is trying to get us to get our eyes off the circumstances, these earth-moving events of this world, and put our eyes back on God. This stanza and every stanza ends with Selah. Now, we aren't exactly sure what Selah means, but what it does is at least it gives us a way to break up this psalm. So let's move to the next stanza. In the next stanza, we encounter Lord in all caps. for the first time. And as I did for the last psalm, I am going to say Yahweh instead, the covenant name of God. It just has that force in this passage of the name of God that the Jews, the Hebrews, didn't even want to pronounce. Reading verses 4 to 7. There is a river whose streams make glad the city of God, the holy habitation of the Most High. God is in the midst of her. She shall not be moved. God will help her when morning dawns. The nations rage. The kingdoms totter. He utters his voice. The earth melts. Yahweh of hosts is with us. The God of Jacob is our fortress. Selah. So the overall point of this stanza is that God is a secure fortress. And that's the second answer. God is our fortress against fear, and God is a secure fortress against fear. It's kind of worthless if your fortress isn't very secure, is it? This is the answer to blank one, secure. So let me start off by reading a modified quote from Leland Ryken, what he says about verse 4. The sudden note of calm enters with the mention of a river. The river, with its flowing, life-giving water and peacefulness, is one of the powerful images of the human imagination. It is filled with associations that make us feel good, and some expressive hymns have capitalized on those associations. And we sang one of them this morning that he mentions, Like a River Glorious. I think it was providential. I was thinking about that psalm even before I'd read these words by Leland. The image of the city is likewise an image that expresses associations of security, community, safety, and much more. Stately descriptions idealize the city yet further. The city of God, referring to Jerusalem, the place where God dwelt in the temple, and the holy habitation of the Most High. Everything considered, verse 4 of this psalm is one of the most vivid verses in the Bible. End of quote. Verse 4 gives us an important aspect of a secure fortress. Water. Humans don't last very long without water, do we? In those days, you could have the highest walls, the thickest walls, the thickest gates, a fortress that the enemy could not penetrate. But if you didn't have water, you were doomed to die very quickly. Without water, you were toast. God's secure fortress has life-giving water. It's a metaphor for God's provision, for God providing for us and allowing us to flourish inside of his fortress. Verse 5 tells us that God's secure fortress city is what? It's unmovable. Even if everything in the world around us is moving, our fortress is secure. Our fortress is unmovable. Unmovable even when under an attack, which often happened at dawn. We're going to read about an attack that was about ready to happen at dawn in a bit. And verse 6 continues this idea of an attack. The nations can rage all they want, but it won't affect God. If God is your fortress, people and nations can rage, but you will be secure. Why? Because you aren't finding security in kingdoms or in anything on this earth. Your security is God. Your secure fortress is God himself. The last line of verse 6 tells us that God is in control. The earth melts. Why? Because God speaks. If you look at Israelite history, and even the literal physical city of Jerusalem, which in this psalm is probably a metaphor for God's people and God's ruling from there, but Jerusalem gave way at some point in its history, didn't it? Multiple times, as a matter of fact. It was destroyed. Why? Because the people had rejected God. They weren't looking to God as their fortress. We can only be secure when God is our fortress. And again, this reminds us not to find security in a kingdom or a nation, especially a nation that has rejected God. The only secure fortress against fear is God. Verse 7 is essentially a restatement of verse 1 with even more vivid language. Yahweh of hosts is with us. God has a vast army at his disposal. God and that army are very present with us. I'd like to read a part of one of my favorite stories in the Bible. I'm not going to ask you to turn there in the interest of time, but 2 Kings 6, if you want to write down that reference and read a bigger story. What was going on was the king of Syria was warring against Israel, but the king of Israel was saved, and it says, I like what it says, he was saved more than once or twice. You know, I guess that's just a Hebrew way of saying, yeah, he was saved quite a bit of times. Why was he saved? Because Elisha told the king of Israel where the king of Assyria was. And so we're going to pick up the story in 2 Kings 11. And the mind of the king of Assyria was greatly troubled because of this thing. No kidding. He called his servants and said to them, "Will you not show me who of us is for the king of Israel?" And one of his servants said, "None, my lord, O king, but Elisha, the prophet who is in Israel, tells the king of Israel the words that you speak in your bedroom." How's that for a hyperbolic language, right? It's like, even in your bedroom what you speak. And he said, "Go and see where he is, that I may send and seize him." It was told him, "Behold, he is in Dothan." So he went there with horses and chariots and a great army, and they came by night and surrounded the city. I find that absolutely hilarious. He couldn't find the king of Israel, but he could find Elisha. So he takes his whole army and surrounds the city. Do you think Elisha was scared? No. Why? Because God was his fortress. So let's pick up the story in verse 15. When the servant of the man of God rose early in the morning and went out, behold, an army with horses and chariots was all around the city. And the servant said, "Alas, my master, what shall we do?" His knees were knocking together. He said, "Do not be afraid, for those who are with us are more than those who are with them." Then Elisha prayed and said, "Yahweh, please open his eyes that he may see." So Yahweh opened the eyes of the young man, and he saw, and behold, the mountain was full of horses and chariots of fire all around Elisha. This Yahweh of hosts is with us. Didn't think I was going to break down there, but the last line of verse 7 should offer us some comfort. The God of Jacob is our fortress. Was Jacob one of the most outstanding guys in the Bible? No. You know what Jacob means? It means, in the Hebrew, supplanter. I guess in some lists it means dog, we found out on Wednesday night. It means, in the Hebrew, supplanter. Jacob supplanted or relieved Esau of his birthright and his blessing. Jacob used cunning and deception to relieve his brother of those valuable things. He did that to his own brother. He was a supplanter, and if you want to write down the reference for that and read it, it's Genesis 27. The God of Jacob should comfort us because, why? Because we're all supplanters. We try and supplant God with other things and bring them into our life. We supplant other things for God. Instead of fearing God, we fear those things. The Christian life isn't a perfect life, but it is a life that is growing to become more like Christ. And if you're a Christian, you have the promise of Hebrews 13:5, that God will never leave you or forsake you, even when you mess up, even when you act like Jacob. Now, of course, this doesn't give us license to mess up all the time, right? And that doesn't mean that we're not going to suffer any consequences as a result of our sin. But the God of Jacob will be with you. The God of Jacob, the God of supplanters, will be our fortress, our secure fortress. The third stanza is an invitation. I love this stanza. A fortress invitation. So that's the answer, the last answer. A fortress invitation. An invitation for you, to make God your fortress for fear. What's interesting is that not only does the psalmist make an invitation, God somehow enters this psalm and God himself makes an invitation. So let's read the psalmist's invitation in verses 8 and 9. Come, behold the works of Yahweh, how he has brought desolations on the earth. He makes wars cease to the end of the earth. He breaks the bow and shatters the spear. He burns the chariots with fire. Come, behold the works of Yahweh. The psalmist invites us to see the world as he sees it. We get a glimpse of the psalmist's worldview and what he's been trying to tell us. Why? It's because the sons of Korah are a living testimony of what it looks like to make God a fortress against fear. If anyone would know, the sons of Korah would know, right? They tell us poetically that Yahweh is ultimately in control. And we had those four those woes. There's just a lot of, poetic things I could do, but those were woes, right? In verses 2 and 3, describing the desolations on the earth. Now we get four he's. Four he's referring to Yahweh in verses 8 and 9. What is he? Let's review those. He has brought those desolations on the earth. Those. He makes wars cease to the end of the earth. He breaks the bow and shatters the spear. He burns the chariots with fire. The psalmist invites his readers to come and behold the works of Yahweh. The warring nations on earth think that they are in control. You see this over and over again, but they're not. Over and over again in the Old Testament, you see God being in control of the events of history. God even uses ungodly nations for his purposes. Jeremiah 43:10 says, "Thus Yahweh of hosts, the God of Israel, thus says Yahweh of hosts, the God of Israel, behold, I will send and take Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, my servant, and I will set his throne above these stones that I have hidden, and he will spread his royal canopy over them." Babylon, an ungodly nation. Isaiah 45:1, thus says Yahweh to his anointed, to Cyrus, whose right hand I have grasped, to subdue nations before him and to loose the belt of kings, to open doors before him that gates may not be closed. Daniel was alive during the reigns of Nebuchadnezzar and Cyrus. Daniel was standing alone in this ungodly nation. He's a good example to us, isn't he? But Cyrus, he calls Cyrus his anointed. The psalmist invites us and his readers to take refuge in a secure fortress, a God who is in control. The word desolations in verse 8 is the word that God uses to describe what will happen to the Israelites if they reject God. It's a strong word. It's the word that is translated horror in Deuteronomy 28:37. And what I'm going to do is read Deuteronomy 28:15 for context, and then I'm going to read verses 36 and 37. But if you will not obey the voice of Yahweh your God, or be careful to do all his commandments and his statutes that I command you today, then all these curses shall come upon you and overtake you. Yahweh will bring you and your king, whom you have set over you, to a nation that neither you nor your fathers have known. And there you shall serve other gods of wood and stone, and you shall become a horror, a proverb, and a byword among all the peoples where Yahweh will lead you away. God is the one who brings desolations and horrors to the earth. Natural desolations and desolations by his servants, even evil nations like Babylon. Now God himself gives us the invitation in verse 10. Be still and know that I am God. I will be exalted in the nations. I will be exalted in the earth. Be still, or as some translations say, cease striving, stop fighting. It's like God is saying to us, stop everything you're doing. Your wars, your fear, whatever it is, just stop. Stop what you're doing and listen to what I'm going to say now. This supports everything that the sons of Korah has said. He's saying to us, I invite you to know me. Know that I am God. And what does God say about himself? I will be exalted among the nations. I will be exalted on the earth. The earth and the nations are categories of what much of what causes us fear, aren't they? Verses 2 and 3 gave us a picture of an uncontrollable earth, at least uncontrollable by man in any way. Anyway, God is in control of the earth as the original sons of Korah would have understood. Why? What did they witness? They saw the Red Sea parted. They saw all the things in Egypt that God did to the Egyptians. And they saw the earth swallow their father. God is saying, don't fear the earth. Fear me. We must also be reminded that it was man's sin that caused the world to be a fearful place. I like what Mark Dever said. He said, we fear death because we weren't meant to die. We are made in the image of an immortal God. I think that is true of just about everything we fear. Think about the earthquakes, right? We fear earthquakes. Why? Because earthquakes weren't meant to be a part of God's original design. Our sin, man's sin, is what causes earthquakes. Man's sin is what causes broken world, and that goes for tornadoes, hurricanes, floods, hail. Some of you experienced hail at your house this week. That wasn't part of God's original creation, thunderstorms. Fear the immovable God, not the movable earth. We could say the same thing about the nations, couldn't we? God is in control of the nations. Isaiah 40:15, behold, the nations are like a drop from a bucket and are accounted as the dust on the scales. Behold, he takes up coastlands like fine dusts. That's what the nations are to God's eyes. In God's eyes, Psalm 22:28, for kingship belongs to Yahweh, and he rules over nations. Do you want to fear the nations or a God who rules over the nations? Choose your fear. Choose wisely. Verse 46 ends in verse 11, which is a repeat of verse 7. Yahweh of hosts is with us. The God of Jacob is our fortress, Selah. The psalmist has told us three times essentially the same thing in verses 1, 7, and 11. God is our fortress. God our fortress is very present with us. And of course, this is based on the fact whether you are you one of God's people? If you're one of God's people, a Christian, you can take part of that fortress. If you're not part of God's kingdom, then he can't be your fortress until you trust in him, until you go to him for refuge. And how do we become one of God's people? Well, he tells us in these verses, God's grace. The God of Jacob is a God of grace. God showed Jacob grace. Reading again from the first line of this, I just wrote it down. The first line of the definition of grace from this dictionary says this about grace. As an attribute of God, his goodness expressed to those who deserve condemnation. Grace is an attribute of God, his goodness expressed to those who deserve condemnation. And as I've said earlier, we're just like Jacob. We deserve God's common condemnation. There is none righteous, none good. This is why Jesus had to come to earth. The sinless Jesus had to be condemned in our place, the perfect sacrifice for our sin. Jesus lived the life that we cannot live without him. We couldn't live it. He had to die. How could we neglect so great a salvation by not trusting in him? When we fear, we are neglecting that salvation. But we can't leave the psalm without talking about hope, eschatological hope. That's just a fancy word for end times hope, future hope. Do you see that here? It's like God is telling us, I will be exalted among the nations. That is a present reality, but it's also a future reality. He's going to be exalted. What is the ultimate and final act of God being exalted among the nations and exalted in the earth? Well, I'm going to read from Revelation 21. It's a little bit longer of a passage, but I think it just gives us this vision of what we should be looking forward to, and a reason not to fear. God will be exalted in this way. Then I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and the sea was no more. Isn't that interesting? If you look, go back and do a study on the sea in this passage, the sea was a frightful thing. There's no more sea. There's no more sea to make us afraid. And I saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride adorned for her husband. And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, Behold, the dwelling place of God is with man. He will dwell with them, and they will be his people, and God himself will be with them as their God. He will wipe away every tear from their eyes, and death shall be no more. Neither shall there be mourning, nor crying, nor pain any more, for the former things have passed away. And he who was seated on the throne said, Behold, I am making all things new. He also said, Write this down, for these words are trustworthy and true. And he said to me, It is done. I am the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end. To the thirsty I will give from the spring of water of life without payment. There's that water again, that sustenance. It's life. The one who conquers will have this heritage, and I will be his God, and he will be my son. The one who conquers will have this heritage, and I will be his God, and he will be my son. And then verse 8 of Revelation 21 says this, But as for the cowardly, right? If you're having fear, you're being a coward. It's not going to work. Fear will defeat you in your Christian life. The cowardly, the faithless, the detestable, as for murderers, the sexually immoral, sorcerers, idolaters, and all liars, their portion will be in the lake that burns with fire and sulfur, which is the second death. Isn't it funny that he fronts all that with cowardly? We are cowards when we don't fear the God of the Bible. We are tempted to be cowards in fearing the things of this earth, aren't we? Verse 22, And I saw no temple in the city, for its temple is the Lord God, the Almighty, and the Lamb. And the city has no need of sun or moon to shine on it, for the glory of God gives it light, and its lamp is the Lamb. By its light will the nations walk, and the kings of earth will bring their glory into it, and its gates will never be shut by day, and there will be no night there. They will bring to it the glory and honor of the nations, but nothing unclean will ever enter it, nor anyone who does what is detestable or false, but only those who are written in the Lamb's book of life. God will be exalted among the nations. God will be exalted in this earth. God has said it. He will do it. That's good news. Let God be your fortress against fear. Let's pray.